So today's presentation is by Monica Mascal, who's an assistant professor of remote sensing and biospatial analysis here in the College of Forest and Bosses. And she received a PhD from the University of Kansas and a Master of Science from the University of Calgary and a Bachelor's in Science from the University of Waterloo in Canada. And her interests are in remote sensing and GIS applications. We're looking at forest structure and applications to forest inventory, watershed management, wildlife habitat, biodiversity, carbon sequestration, biomass mapping, and conversion. And she particularly voiced, that's not the word. I'm going to say my eye, kind of voiced in my eye. Anyway, she's going to tell us today about a bit about LiDAR. And the topic of her talk here is wetland monitoring with high resolution remote sensing and GIS. Good morning.
Thanks, Bob. Correction, I'm actually not going to tell you anything about LiDAR today. We're not using LiDAR in this research, but I'll mention how it'd be beneficial to this type of work.
I didn't think you could give a talk without mentioning LiDAR.
I know, it's been like that for the last little while. So thank you very much. I know many of you have been looking at wetlands throughout the talks through this semester and probably through your academic career. We're looking at a slightly different type of a wetland. It's a little bit of an oxymoron. In fact, it's an arid wetland. These things do exist and they do exist in eastern Washington. There we go. So this is a pilot project that I'm presenting right now. It's with the Nature Conservancy. We're looking at a fairly small area to develop a remote sensing-based algorithm to try and extract and automate the extraction of arid wetlands. Why start off here? Well, it is a little easier to map arid wetlands than it is to map wetlands that could be surrounded or even covered with forests or dense vegetation. So that's one reason. But there are many other reasons why arid regions in particular are interesting to scientific research in general. So we're looking at Douglas County. You're looking at Columbia River right here, Columbia River, and a tiny little sector of our study area. Glaciated and non-glaciated landscape. So we're actually noticing that some of the characteristics of the wetlands have a lot to do with the geomorphology and the geology of this landscape, which this is where LiDAR would be really beneficial to be able to map topography with a laser like the one I'm using right now to point things at. But we're not doing that in this project. We're using traditional aerial remote sensing techniques such as aerial photographs and implementing our analysis with satellite analysis. So, as I mentioned, arid landscapes are actually quite interesting. One of the reasons is they're believed to be regions that are especially sensitive to climatic change. They're already under stress due to dry climate, water shortages, or water limitations. So if you have climate change and that climate change is expected to reduce water availability, that can really impact this type of a landscape. So even a small decline in precipitation can have a significant and in fact dramatic impact on an arid wetland. Increasingly, these regions are facing political and social conflicts as scarce water resources decline, and this is likely to continue in the future. There's quite a bit of agriculture in this area, and of course, as water becomes a valuable resource that's quickly being depleted, we'll run into issues of agriculture utilizing water resources for wetlands. There's been some studies done to try and estimate already the percentage of wetland loss. This is just a rough number 31% of wetlands have been lost since 1780 to 1980 in the state of Washington. But we're trying to get more accurate estimates and more recent estimates as well. We're also interested in very small wetlands. When I say we, I really mean the Nature Conservancy, because the goal of this effort is to make wise conservation decisions, wise management decisions, as well as wise policy decisions. So the Nature Conservancy came to us to decide, or to help them decide, which parts of these landscapes have the highest diversity of a wetland. And based on that, they're looking at some conservation practices. Of course, diversity of a wetland is a tricky question, because how do you monitor diversity of a wetland? There's different things you can do. Remote sensing definitely has a bias and a certain perspective to how we look at diversity. We look at diversity basically through space and time, and this is going to be the fundamental concept in this talk. So there's been remote sensing methods used for quite a while now to monitor wetlands or to monitor changes in wetlands. We can categorize them roughly into two categories. One is to use satellite remote sensing. Satellite allows you to have a larger spatial extent, and you can revisit the area more often than you would with an aerial sensor, such as aerial photographs. Unfortunately, there's always trade-offs with remote sensing. If you look at large spatial extents, meaning you covered the whole state of Washington with one image, or maybe two or three satellite-based images, dependent on which sensor you're looking at, you're not going to have as much detail captured within that imagery. Simple concept, just like with your digital camera. If you take a photo close up, you get more detail. If you take a photo farther away, you get less detail, especially if you try and zoom in on a particular area. Of course, that's limited by the pixel resolution of your camera, but even with the high, I would say 12 megapixels resolution cameras, you notice the limitation of detail in the imagery. Excuse me. I'm fighting a sore throat, so I'm going to try and get through this here. All right, aerial photographs. With aerial photographs, we can cover a fairly small area, but we can cover that area in an extensive amount of detail, which is very useful. However, just because you have a small area in detail, you might miss out on the landscape concept and questions that you're trying to ask through remote sensing. And I think climate change issues are landscape issues. They're large-scale issues that address the full landscape. There's also differences in the way we do analysis with these two different types of data sets. Specifically, with aerial photography, we've been relying on time-intensive manual delineation of wetlands. So photo interpreter sits down and manually outlines where the wetland is on the photograph. It's very time-consuming, and in fact, by the time you're done analyzing one data set, your data could be already out of date. A new photography mission might have been acquired, or you're nearing a new acquisition. So very time-intensive approach. I want to set the stage a little bit still, because we have to think about the definition of what is a wetland. I think, if anything, throughout this project, that's the big question that we've been learning. As I've mentioned before, in remote sensing, we do have a bias and a perspective. To us, a wetland is what remotely sensed data can capture as a wetland, which might differ from what you might observe on the ground. So that definition should be in the back of your head. There are textbooks written on what are wetlands, and in fact, the definition is quite complicated. But let's explore that a little bit. So you're looking at the oxymoron and arid wetland, and it's pretty easy to at least delineate the open water component of this wetland. So if you were to map this, you might manually delineate the open water on here. You might delineate the wetland based on the vegetation that you can interpret in the photograph, and we do image interpretations through texture and pattern analysis, and you can see even with this oblique photograph, your outline might be a little bit different when you begin to consider some kind of vegetation in your interpretation, or perhaps still wet areas or areas where you have mineral deposits from a previous higher water level event. Or you can outline based on additional salt grasses or additional vegetation that you can associate with a wetland and even expand that area. And in fact, if I took this photo at a different time, this delineation would differ again. So what is a wetland? How do we delineate these wetlands? In fact, the example I showed you was pretty simple. How would you delineate this wetland? Where is the wetland? There is no wet. It's completely dry at this time of the year. This is fall last year. How about here? So where is the wetland? This is still an arid wetland. We can tell that by the vegetation that's growing there. How would you go about delineating this? And here, where is the edge of the wetland? How would you approach that delineation? Of course, the true way of delineating the wetland is getting a little bit dirty. You gotta get a shovel and you start digging and you start looking at the soils which are associated with wetland soils. Of course, to delineate a wetland, it would take a lot of soil pit digging to determine where is the boundary, where is the edge of this wetland. In fact, you could potentially disturb and destroy the wetland by doing so. In fact, you would probably spend months studying just one wetland. But we're interested in landscape level analysis, not just one location. You're looking at one of our Nature Conservancy folks who's actually trained in delineating wetlands on the ground. Why is it good to have a person like that on your team? I strongly believe with the approach that I'm showing you today, the analyst, the person who's doing the analysis, needs a tremendous amount of training. And that training continues through the process of the analysis, starting with going on the ground. We actually went on the ground first, which is not uncommon, but unusual for a remote sensing project to spend that much time on the ground. Our goal was to delineate at least 50 wetlands. We ended up delineating almost double that, from what I remember correctly. And Megan Halbisky, who's in the audience today, is the graduate student working on this effort. So the delineation was done in the field with a high-grade GPS, walking around. For some wetlands, we only captured the center point of the wetland and a descriptor of it. All of this data was collected to help Megan train the computer, train the classifier to be able to outline a wetland. And of course, with a lot of field work comes a lot of duct tape. So this was interesting. I just had a chance to look at some of these pictures and saw innovative implementation of an attachment for a GPS antenna that Megan had to use in the field. All right. Remote sensing approach. we're using aerial photography in the first phase of our analysis, and many of you are probably familiar with Google Earth, so one of the things I wanted to do is quickly go on to Google Earth and look at the landscape a little bit and capture some imagery. By the way, the latest version of Google Earth has historical imagery. We're looking at 1940s. There's a date in here that's barely visible, but we're looking at 1940s aerial photography of tiny little portion of our study area. Here's that same location in the 1960s. Notice what's happened to the wetlands. Their color has completely changed, or their gray level, from bright to dark. Let me go back one day here. So, black, open water to probably dry. Dry beds encrusted by mineral deposits. We're looking at, I think this is a 1970s image. Again, dry wetlands. And another image. The previous one was from a different time of year. We were looking at December previously. Now we're looking at July. What else has changed with the data? One of the big things that has changed is we've gone through black and white to color photography. More recent photography is now captured in color instead of captured in black and white. I'm going to put a KMZ file link to your class so you can go and revisit this location on Google Earth, and you'll see the detail of the imagery a lot better than we can with the representation of the projector that we have. Here's the most recent photograph. This is actually color. I know it still looks kind of grayish, but it is color. And if you look at Google Earth, but also if you look at remotely sensed data sets, one of the biggest questions I have is, when was the photograph taken? With historical data sets, we often lose what is called the metadata for the photography. That metadata is critical for us. If we don't know the time of year when the photograph is actually acquired, it can limit us our interpretation of that photograph. So all of those things need to be taken into consideration. The differences between black and white versus color, the differences on the timing of the photography. You probably saw slight shifts in the photographs. That's not me embedding the imagery incorrectly in PowerPoint. That's actually a georeference shift. The imagery isn't tied together. It's Google Earth. Of course, in remote sensing, you have to make sure that you connect the imagery to one another properly, or you might induce changes, which in fact are just artifacts of poor co-registration of photographs. We use roads most of the time to do that. But imagine looking at a landscape that doesn't have a lot of roads. What are you going to use to do that co-registration? So, brought up a lot of questions, a lot of limitations. How do we deal with these discrepancies, and why bother? Why would we even want to do this when it seems like there's so many things that we need to resolve before we can use remote sensing? And again, I believe the answer is you can look at the whole landscape, and there's no other way, at least that I know of, for us to travel back into the 1940s, 1970s, and to look at these landscapes. We can do a little bit of that by discussing the landscape, social studies, discussing them with people who've lived in the area. And that's actually a very useful piece of information. I think at the beginning of your semester, Steve talked about some work in China and some ethnographic historical knowledge that can be added into geospatial data. All right. I believe that with remote sensing, there are some new trends developing right now over the last 5 years or so that are allowing us to do better remote sensing analysis. And all those trends are tied to the resolution of remotely sensed data. And by resolution, I mean the spatial resolution, how much detail we see in the data, the temporal resolution, how often we can revisit a location, as well as the hyperspectral or spectral resolution of the data. Can we look at the landscape in black and white and color, or perhaps in a region of the electromagnetic spectrum where our eyes cannot perceive information? Think about thermal infrared. We can't see it, but thermal infrared exists, and in fact, you could probably sense some of the temperature differences in that region. Or we can capture it with a sensor. And in fact, we can capture anywhere along the near-infrared region and extract a lot of information about our landscapes. As I've mentioned before, there are trade-offs between using one versus another type of remote sensing. If you rely, let's look at the spatial remote sensing realm. If you rely on high-resolution spatial remote sensing, you're probably going to end up with a high-resolution satellite or aerial acquisition. So it could be QuickBird. It could be LiDAR. LiDAR is actually a high spatial resolution sensor, but it senses in three dimensions instead of traditional remote sensing, which is a flat two-dimensional image, unless you can get the imagery in stereo, and then you could get a third dimension out of your data. So you have a lot of detail. You've flown an aircraft to acquire that data. However, how often can you go back and revisit the landscape with that type of sensor? If it's a satellite, you might have a revisit time of every few weeks. If it's an aerial sensor, your revisit time might be limited by the amount that you can afford to fly an aircraft. So fuel prices are going up. It might be difficult to revisit a location just due to the cost of mobilizing an aircraft. Also, hyperspectral. Most of the time, aerial imagery is not collected in hyperspectral unless you fly a specific hyperspectral acquisition. Those are very rare. They can be flown at high resolution. They're also extremely expensive, rely on extensive amount of field calibration with a spectroradiometer to make sure that the data you're collecting is of quality to extract information. And in fact, lately we've had at least one satellite that does hyperspectral remote sensing, Hyperion. However, this is a research satellite. It's not fully operational. You can't just buy imagery off of it on the geospatial market. So we're not quite there yet. And of course, if you think of hyperspectral, the temporal is another question here, because how often can you task a hyperspectral satellite, which is a research satellite and could go offline any day, and we don't have a replacement satellite going up to replace it. We also don't have a lot of aerial sensors that are flown in the hyperspectral mode, and as I've mentioned, they're expensive. However, we do have some very good hypertemporal data sets. And I'm going to throw in Landsat in there as a multi-temporal and getting to hypertemporal. Hypertemporal, the rough definition for hyper is over 100 observations. We're getting there with Landsat data. We have been collecting Landsat since 1972. And in some regions of the globe, we get multiple images, up to a dozen, if not more, images throughout the year. So we're pushing the hypertemporal envelope with Landsat. We also have sensors which are coarser in spatial resolution, 250 meters, pixel resolution to 1 kilometer pixel resolution, that have been flown since the late 1960s, 1970s. at a global scale. And in fact, some of these sensors collect data at a biweekly resolution at a global scale. We've been observing the Earth for over 30 years, every 2 weeks, every place on Earth. However, we lose out on the spatial resolution. The detail isn't there. And in fact, the spectral resolution is limited as well. The best data sets out of that are a vegetation index, which combines two bands out of remotely sensed data instead of multiple bands along the electromagnetic spectrum. So there are a lot of tools just in remote sensing and in the new version of remote sensing. I believe the combination of these tools is what can allow us to do better interpretation of landscapes. And in fact, it's not just remote sensing. I think remote sensing belongs to a suite of tools which we call geospatial technologies, geospatial tools, GIS, remote sensing, cartography, surveying, GPS. I could go on and on. Landscape metrics and landscape ecology, which really tie to GIS as well. All these things are geospatial tools, and now the toolbox has grown. So combining these tools allows us to do pretty powerful interpretation of the landscape. All right, this is the project sort of in a nutshell, or at least the big picture of the project here. What we're trying to do is use aerial photography, satellite imagery, the spatial patterns, as well as the multispectral patterns out of these data sets and tie them to some climatic information to capture what I like to call the spatial and spectral temporal signatures of wetlands. So if you're familiar with traditional remote sensing, you know what spectral signatures are. But I believe that there are also spatial signatures that features on the landscape have. And in fact, the spectral signatures can have a temporal component to them. Wetlands change. I proved that to you by showing you the Google Earth photographs. The reflectance change. We had a wet wetland to start off with and pretty dry wetlands after that. They change in time. The spectral reflectance of those wetlands changes. So does their shape. As they're expanding, as they're contracting, their shape is also changing over time. I think we can actually summarize these things and come up with curves. So if you started off with a wet wetland, went to a dry, semi-dry, and a slightly wetter, this is what you might summarize that spectral signature to look like over time. However, that signature might be very different. It could even be reversed for a different wetland, different type of a wetland. You might start off with a dry and progressively get wetter. You might start off with a wet and progressively get drier. You might start off with wet, go to dry, wet, dry, and a spectrum of things in between. I think our impact on the landscape has a relationship with what these signatures look like. So by studying these signatures, we can start to think about our own policy that we're implementing on the landscape. The same is true with spatial temporal signatures. So a wetland can start off fairly large, perhaps contract over time, or drastically change. For example, if a farmer is changing agricultural practices and utilizes more or less water with each agricultural season, that will have a dramatic impact on the size of the wetland. It will have an impact on the spectral signature of that wetland as well. So we can have a spatial signature for wetlands that allows us to begin to look at human use and human practices of the landscape. So some bigger applications here. First of all, we want to understand wetland dynamics and potential factors that might influence wetland change, such as land use decision, as well as climatic changes. We want to be able to identify less vulnerable wetlands, for example, wetlands that are not impacted by climate change or not as drastically impacted by climate change, to implement long-term preservation. We still have some hope with these wetlands. Of course, once you get to this process, I think it becomes necessary to begin to communicate with other scientists. I don't think you would base policy just on your remotely sensed map of wetlands and your spatial and spectral temporal signatures of the landscape. What you need to look at is how are species utilizing that landscape? What's the species diversity of that landscape? At least one thing we can do is focus our research to potential areas of conservation. So we now know where to look to begin to understand if conservation even has an impact. And of course, these techniques can be adapted to other arid regions of the world. And in fact, it's likely that these techniques can be adapted to non-arid regions as well. All right, so hierarchical feature extraction. This is really the key component of the talk. What I'm going to do here is just show you the method we've developed, the remote sensing method that allows us to derive the wetlands from aerial photographs. And I'll just show you that for one date of air photo imagery. So we're using feature extraction, sometimes called object-based image classification or object extraction method. It's fundamentally different from the traditional method of remote sensing, where we take a pixel and we assign a class to that pixel, and thus we can categorize all pixels in our image. With feature extraction, we often take the associated contextual information for an object within our data, object or class, and use that information with the pixel values to assign it to a category. I'll try and show you an example here in a minute. And as I've mentioned before, I strongly believe the image analyst training and skills is what makes this method a powerful new tool for high spatial resolution data. In fact, we've started to run this type of analysis through historical aerial photos, and there's been a lot of development in landscape ecology applying this this process to look at and monitor landscape change with historical data. But again, the image analyst is the key component, and I believe the training of that analyst is critical. So feature extraction, I think, is the marriage of human cognitive ability as well as the computer's ability to automate a process. So right now, I'm going to test your cognitive ability. You've been looking at this image a little bit. Any idea what we're looking at here? Excellent. Usually we just hear a dog. Now, some of you are going, where? But I bet that a number of you, as soon as you heard a dog or a Dalmatian, you're able to begin to outline where the dog is in the photograph. True or false? Do we have a few more seeing the dog? I see a few nods. How about I begin to show you the outline? Head, front paw, back paw. Starting to see the dog? It's not going to appear purely clearly, but there's a cognitive process in your brain that's allowing you to extract that information from this Very simple, black and white image. Computers can't do that, but you can. And I, as I said, it's the combination of the human cognitive skills and the computer's ability to automate some of these things that makes feature extraction such a powerful process. But it usually takes a trained eye to do that. So maybe the first time looking at this, it might be difficult. Maybe you've never seen a Dalmatian in your life, so you don't really know what that type of animal looks like, or that it is a dog. So all of these pieces of information is what a human analyst can pull together into their interpretation. So we start off with aerial photography in a software. We use a software called Definion's Developer. It used to be called eCognition. Now it's Definion's Developer. It'll probably be called eCognition in a few weeks, and then likely something else in a few months. The company's playing around with the name. It is a feature or object-based approach, and in fact, it's a hierarchical approach. So you not only identify the objects, but potential subcategories of objects. There's a lot of remote sensing that I'm glazing over, like finding the data, getting the data. If you're lucky, it's going to be in a digital format, but if you look at historical data sets, it's likely hard copy photographs that you're going to have to scan at good quality, mosaic, and georectified. So all of a sudden, it becomes a costly pre-processing step. But once you do it, you have that data, and you don't necessarily just have to pull out wetlands out of the data. In fact, by pulling out other features, you can do a better job at classifying wetlands, georectifying, making sure things tie from different dates if you're going to be using different dates. Next process is what we call segmentation. So we use sort of a proprietary algorithm to fracture the image, fracture it into components that have similar spatial textural shape characteristics. That's the best way to describe it. And you can see just by doing this fracturing, I have some polygons that are pretty much open water. So at least I know that to get at open water, this is going to be fairly easy just through the segmentation approach. I'm simplifying this. There's a lot that goes into the segmentation. You can do fine-level segmentation. You can do coarse-level segmentation. You can do hierarchical segmentation. The learning curve for this software is about like this. It's steep, and in fact, it continues to be like that through the learning process because, again, it's the analyst that is the tool and a big component of this methodology. All right, once we have segmented the data, one thing we might do is start to point at things on the landscape and start saying, well, these things are trees. These things are upland vegetation. And just showing the computer where your eyes are seeing these things. It's called training. And it's very common in both approaches to remote sensing analysis, per pixel or feature extraction. You're training the algorithm, you're training the computer. But you're going to do something a little different with that training. You're going to define different components of those categories for the algorithm other than just the value of the pixel. So, and we call these dimensions. And in fact, in per-pixel remote sensing, we do have multiple dimensions. You can create principal components. You can do canonical transformation. You can create NDVI. Those are all additional dimensions to remotely sense data. But they don't include things such as shape and pattern within or outside texture. And they do in feature extraction. Essentially, what you're doing here is trying to maximize the separation between the two classes that you're working with. To a remote sensing analyst, It's nothing new. Batteria distance is a way for us to separate signatures, let's say, for a tree versus a road. But we're doing this in multi dimensions, and the tricky thing is we're using more advanced object features, such as layer values, which are sort of the digital numbers within the pixel, but also the shape of an object, the texture within or outside of the object, and some additional components. For example, hierarchy could be a class within a class. So you know that a certain class, for example, desks with little tables on them, will only appear in the classroom, not in the hallway. That's within class hierarchical approach. You can implement that all through feature extraction. So a more powerful approach to doing things. The next step, thresholding. For each one of those feature categories, we threshold and tell the computer where the classes that we're interested in fall in between. Why is this important? It's important because we do this visually. And it is, again, the analyst that drives the algorithm, not the algorithm driving the analyst. The analyst decides when to cut things off for each one of these thresholds. Here's just an example of refining and subcategorizing the classes. So you can embed a class. For example, wet areas can have additional subcategories associated with them. In the end, you might produce a map that colors all of these things thematically the same, but the algorithm sees them very differently, and you use a different strategy to extract these things out of the imagery. And in fact, you do this for all of the features, all of the classes. The more classes, the more features, the more complicated this approach gets. So this is the algorithm logic, and really it is just a logical algorithm that you've trained based on your visual and contextual understanding of the imagery. And you come up with a classification. So here's the number of classes that we've had in our final preliminary classification. Notice that the wetland is only one little component of this classification. All these other things are also things that we're striving to extract from the imagery, because they help us separate the wetlands out. So in fact, we come up with a fairly complex thematic map of the landscape that's driven at wetlands, but it could have a different application to it. And let me show you some results here. So here's the photograph. Here's our classification. You can see these green areas are emergent wetlands. Bluish areas are open water. There's a lot of little fragmented emergent wetlands for this date of the imagery, which I believe is May 2006, I think. A very large area of the imagery is what we think could be wetlands. Let's look at something a little bit more familiar closer up. And here are some of our categories. So we've got emergent wetlands, green, blue is open water, as well as some additional classes. I'm just going to jump back and forth and show you, pay attention to this one little area here. What is that? To us, it's an emergent wetland right now in the classification. But what is it when I go back and forth? What are these dots right along here? Trees? Yeah, so we've got a tree as a wetland problem. There's a lot of refinement that needs to go in. How do you address that? Well, with feature extraction, it's actually not that difficult. We have in gone there just yet. This isn't hard to do, to pull out little areas that are circular in shape and dark in color, and maybe even associated with one another, and maybe even have a shadow cast to their left side. So trees, especially individually standing trees on this arid landscape, are things that we can refine and remove from the classification. So how did we really do? What you're looking at, the red area here, is Fish and Wildlife Service 1982, delineation of wetlands. For this particular pilot area, Fish and Wildlife identified about 500 emergent wetlands and about 120 open water. Our classification identified over 5,000 emergent wetlands, many of them greater than 1/20 of an acre. We also have 14,500 emergent wetlands smaller than that. So we can go very, very slow, small, we think. Open water, we have three times as much open water, and I'm just saying polygons, not the area of these polygons. So the red is Fish and Wildlife, the blue is ours, the green is ours. There's a lot of stuff missing. Well, how do we know that's actually a good classification? Completely different component. There's another student that is working with us that we're training to do air photo interpretation to run an accuracy assessment for us, because we can't go back to 2006 and validate what's on the ground. So we're going to have to try and do this through image interpretation. All right, multispectral change. I've mentioned we can capture information out of Landsat imagery and have a spectral temporal signature for a wetland. If you look at really awful display, but right in there is a wetland that we were looking at in our aerial photograph. That wetland has certain pixel values and characteristics, and since we have about 20 different Landsat images, we can monitor those over time. We can monitor the spatial patterns, and I'm going to go back to forestry here for a bit. Patches of forests have been analyzed through landscape metrics. It's a common technique in landscape ecology. Those patches can have a certain exterior area, certain core area. All of those things can help us describe the class. Let's apply that very quickly to our shapes. Again, the blue is open water. Notice the smoothness of that curve versus the more jagged emergent wetland. I could just use that metric to help me separate those two. And hopefully additional metrics for finer refinement of these wetlands. All right, what have we learned? Well, the analyst. That's the tool. The computer is just another resource. Field experience. You can't have an analyst without field experience. In fact, we're going back in the field to refine our feature extraction. More expensive imagery isn't necessarily better. I'm not going to go into detail of explaining that, but it is a conclusion that we've made. You need to use the appropriate remote sensing analytical tools for the data sets that you have. You can use existing aerial photography, and potentially you should explore the usage of LIDAR. The final step here that I do want to point out is trying to tie all of that into policy. So maybe looking at the Washington State parcel data set and supplementing that data set that's been developed by RTI is the future goal of the project. And of course, Couldn't do it without all the help. If you're interested in going out with us in the field sometime in March, this is the email address to contact Megan at. She might still be looking for some field assistance.
Okay.